Nightlife Science.
Yes, we speak to Charlie Lineweaver regularly to get an update on matters scientific. Charlie, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, Earthling.
Well, yes, here we are on Earth, but there is the Perseverance rover on Mars. Now, we discussed this last week. Of course, the excitement that was building as the Perseverance rover landed, last Friday, I think, our time. But it worked. NASA successfully landed this rover with the helicopter drone onto the surface of Mars. We've seen a couple of early pictures, haven't we? So it looks so far so good, doesn't it, Charlie?
Well, what's most exciting about this is just, I think they were just released today or the day before, were these videos that were taken by the cameras that seem to be almost all over the place on this instrument. And for example, you could see the heat shield going off. You could see first of all, to slow down this thing, it's going really, really fast towards Mars. First, you have a heat shield. Then you got to get rid of the heat shield. Then you have this giant parachute that just expands into the sky. And you can see a video of this whole parachute going up and inflating and then slowing the thing down. And then you have this sky crane, which is a robotic drone with cables underneath it. And then that slowly lowers the biggest and most sophisticated rover that's ever been put on the surface of Mars. And one indication of that is, hey, they took the highest resolution images from the surface of Mars just the other day. So this really is a wonderful thing. I have a lot of high hopes for this thing, and I know you like this helicopter. I was able to find out a few more details about this helicopter for you, though.
Oh, yeah? Go and tell. Well, let me in.
Well, first of all, they're going to be up to 5 flights, and these flights will not occur until March, so not for another week or so, at least.
Oh, okay.
And they will be up to 90 seconds, and they're kind of going to go 50 meters or so each one. And here's a cool thing. If they do it at twilight, one group has suggested that you will see that they will see a glow from this helicopter, because there'll be dust, and these rotors will be going around so quickly that they will, there's an effect. I forget the name of this effect, but when you have a military helicopter in a dusty region, the blades of the helicopter are going so fast and hitting so much sand that they start to glow, and they will possibly be able to see this if they launch this helicopter in the twilight on Mars. The basic thing is, though, it might be the case that we discover stromatolites or some type of ancient microbial mats, and that would really revolutionize astrobiology, and you'll have a lot more people studying life elsewhere in the universe, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, it must be said at this early stage, because I've had a look at them too, that, if you're fascinated by pictures from Mars, some of the pictures that we're getting back from this Perseverance rover already, including the live landing, is really, yes. Really quite impressive, aren't they? I mean, these are the cameras on board the rover that filmed itself landing.
Yeah, I think they're taking a lesson out of the SpaceX playbook, because SpaceX has cameras everywhere. And it's not only really important for if something goes wrong to figure out what went wrong, but also it's entertaining for those of us who would love to participate in these things with an eye. Hey, look at that.
Exactly.
And it really is a higher level of entertainment as we get more cameras everywhere.
Anyway, so far so good. It's landed. It's been successfully deployed. And, well, we look forward to, well, it's supposed to last for a year or more, isn't it, Charlie?
Oh, well, yes. But this is a mission to find ancient life on Mars. So they're going to be looking for, as I said, ancient stromatolites, landed in a place called Jezero Crater. And that was a delta from an ancient river that flowed into a fairly large crater. And so that's what they'll be looking through, this fossilized delta for organic material and possibly bacterial mats. And if we can find evidence of bacterial mats on Mars, that will be incredible, because that might indicate an independent origin of life on, origins of life in our solar system alone. And that has large implications for how much life we should expect elsewhere in the universe.
Okay, now, meanwhile elsewhere, astronomers have spotted a promising blob around our nearest neighbour star, which is Alpha Centauri A. But yes, we don't know what the blob is. Is it a planet or not?
That's right. This is so the history behind this discovery of a blob is that about 5 years ago, Yuri Milner, a billionaire from Silicon Valley, invested in about a $3 million instrument that was put on the European Southern Observatory telescopes. And in 2019, for about 8 weeks or so, it stared at Alpha Centauri A. And that's a star we can see here. And it's very bright, one of the brightest stars, I think the third brightest star in the sky. And they analyzed this data, but then the instrument was shut down because of COVID. And so they analyzed whatever data they had, and they found by comparing the image of Alpha Centauri A and Alpha Centauri B with each other, then subtracting them, they got a blob, and they don't know what this blob is. I would say it's 50% likely that this blob is some type of instrumental defect, and 50% that it's something more interesting than that. But we have to wait until the COVID gets over for this thing to start looking again at Alpha Centauri.
Yes, all right. Okay, now...
These are the uncertainties that scientists love to live with because it keeps everybody on their seat. Well, what is it? We don't know. Look harder.
Sunlight might be able to power micro-aircraft flying above the stratosphere in something called the mesosphere. This is an area, of course, that's so high that planes can't fly and balloons can't float. And satellites can't survive either.
Yeah, so just a little bit of background on this. When you look up in the sky, you see clouds, and the clouds are in a region called the troposphere, from 0 to about 10 kilometers in height. And if you've ever taken a long airplane trip, the pilots love to be above the troposphere. They like to fly at about above 10 kilometers, maybe 12 or 13 kilometers right there. The highest flying planes can go, maybe 20 kilometers, maybe even 50 kilometers. The highest flying balloons get that high. But satellites have to be where there's no atmosphere at all. And so they have to be above like 500 kilometers.
Right.
So there's this region that nothing can fly in. It's called the mesosphere. Some scientists call it the ignorosphere, from about 50 kilometers to about 100 kilometers up. So that's 50 kilometers of altitude where we can't even sample. We can't do it in flight. We can't do it with rockets because the rocket, well, you can fly through it very quickly with the rockets, but you can't stay there. So what this new technology might be able to do is create airplanes that can fly. And how do you do that? Well, they take solar energy and they create hot underneath. Underneath these micro airplanes, they put they make it hot. So when particles from the atmosphere hit it, they bounce off very hard and very fast from the bottom, but the top is cool, and so they don't bounce off as high, as fast, and that gives lift to these things. But it's a very, very small amount of lift. It's kind of like a radiometer. I don't know if you know a radiometer. It's kind of like these weather vane inside of evacuated.
Oh, thing. Yeah, that's right.
Those are called radiometers. Hmm. And that moves around in much the same way, but it's very, very light. And it's not a very powerful source of a force or lift. But they're trying to maximize this and create micro aircraft that, for the first time, can fly in this mesosphere from 50 to 100 kilometers altitude. That'll tell us all about a whole gigantic portion of the atmosphere that we hardly know anything about.
Yeah. No, exactly. All right. Now, speaking of that's high altitudes, but then there are, let's go deep. The deepest land-dwelling microbes have been found at the bottom of a 5 kilometer deep hole in China, where the temperature is 137 degrees.
Yeah. Now, as an astrobiologist, we're really, really interested in figuring out what are the extremes of life? What are the hottest temperatures that life can stand? What are the coldest temperatures? What is the least amount of water life can live with? What is the most amount of water, et cetera? So we're always interested in these extreme regions. And this is new research coming out of China. They dug a hole 5 kilometers deep. And this was not a hole dug for oil. It was a hole dug for science.
Yeah.
And so they had biologists monitoring the rocks and the bacteria that were coming up as they got deeper and deeper and deeper. And so the new discovery was, well, up until now, we had a limit of about 122 Celsius as the maximum temperature for life. But here they're reporting ambient temperatures at a 5-kilometer hole of 137 Celsius, so 15 degrees warmer than the current record. So they're setting a new record. Now, I should say that this is still kind of, you know, I read the paper and it was really not as definitive as one would have wished. So they have these things that look like life forms, but they when you live 5 kilometers down, you don't go around, you know, waving your hands or anything. These are bacterial life forms that, you know, are in some sense dormant compared to what we're used to at the surface. And so they have to say, are these really life forms?
Yeah.
And so it's not as definitive as I would wish. But if they are life forms, then the new record has been set for both depth and maximum temperature where you can live.
Okay. Now, speaking of other discoveries, the oldest DNA on record has been found from a million-year-old mammoth tooth.
Yes. Now, isn't that cool?
Yeah.
So the DNA, our knowledge of DNA has exploded recently. And you may remember you and I have talked about Neanderthals' genomes, right? And you said, oh, I'm 2% Neanderthal.
Yeah.
Well, all that was based on getting sequences of Neanderthal genes that are on, you know, 50,000 or 100,000 years old. But here we're talking about DNA that's 10 times older, a million-year-old, from the teeth of mammoths. And that not only helps you figure out what the phylogenetic tree of mammoths is like, but the reason why it was so well preserved is because mammoths, as you may know, lived in cold regions. And when this thing died, it froze. And so cold temperatures preserve DNA better than warm temperatures. If this mammoth had died at the equator, for example, there would probably be nothing left to sequence among its DNA. And so the optimal circumstances was a big tooth to protect the DNA and then very, very cold temperatures. And this adds to, you know, we're getting closer to Jurassic Park here, where we're going to find older and older DNA. And I'm hoping to find, I think we're on the verge of finding Homo erectus DNA and sequencing it, because that was only that's about the same time as this, a million years old. So maybe we'll find some Homo erectus DNA and we'll find out that all of us have 10% of Homo erectus DNA inside of us. And so you shouldn't call them Homo erectus. They should be Homo sapiens erectus.
Yes, exactly. All right.
Charlie's prediction for this week.
I know, exactly. Now, just finally, scientists are trying to spot new viruses before they cause pandemics. How are they doing this?
Well, you know, this pandemic is causing worldwide, that's a pandemic, it's everywhere in the world. So billions, maybe even trillions of dollars this is costing us. Now, you know, about 100 years ago, people said, hey, this hurricane came, we didn't know it was coming. Let's have the great idea of putting weather stations out there or weather buoys or putting weather stations all around the world so you can predict, the hurricane are coming or a typhoon or a drought or whatever. And so we've become really good at making worldwide weather and predicting when a hurricane is coming. We get 2 or 3 days of forewarning. But we don't have that for viruses. And viruses hit, they're kind of like gigantic storms. But what scientists are proposing now, at a price that must be like 1/100th of the pandemic price, is very analogous to the way we have weather stations. We could have viral stations. And that was essentially just taking blood of people and doing serological tests. In other words, looking at the antibodies that are in blood as a function of time, as a function of space all over the world, and essentially using human bodies as weather stations when you do the blood tests. And that's not going to be very much, it will be very cheap compared to, you know, boom, getting hit by a pandemic and then shutting down or closing businesses or everybody getting sick or 500,000 people in the U.S. dying because of it. I mean, with a little bit of effort, such a weather station analogous virosphere monitoring system could be set up based on blood. And that's what the idea is. And I think it's a great idea. It should happen. And we'll see if Bill Gates will fund it or what.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. Intriguing idea. Okay. All right. Well, excitement everywhere. Charlie, terrific to talk. Let's chat again soon.
All right, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.